Okay, it looks like we're at the top of the hour, so we will get started now. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Ribbons, and I am the business manager at TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. TEDx is a science-based nonprofit research institute. Our mission is to reduce the use and production of chemicals that interfere with healthy hormone function. We achieve this by identifying and answering pressing scientific questions and collaborating with partners to improve human and ecological health. I would like to welcome you to today's call, which is titled Potential Neurodevelopmental Effects of Oil and Gas Operations, a Literature Review. Our moderator today will be Kim Schultz, TEDx's Oil and Gas Research Coordinator. Our speaker has provided slides to accompany her presentation, and the link to download them was emailed to everyone who registered for the call. If you still need to download the slides, you can do so now from our website at tedx.org. At the bottom of our homepage, click on TEDx Teleconference Calls and Videos. Once on that page, under Upcoming Calls, you will find a link to today's call. There you will find a link to download the slide presentation. This call is scheduled for 30 minutes with time at the end of the call for questions. Due to the high number of participants on the call, if you have a question or comment, we ask that you post these to our live chat. You can access the live chat by going to the call page and clicking on the link provided, and no password is necessary. We will be monitoring all of the comments and questions throughout the call, and we'll read questions to the speaker after her presentation. Right now, everyone has been muted with the exception of our moderator and our speaker. As I noted, the call will last 30 minutes, and it is being recorded. With that, I'm going to hand things over to you, Kim.
Thank you, Chris. I'd like to welcome everyone to our call today as well and introduce our speaker, Ellen Webb. Ms. Webb has an MPH in Health Policy and Management from Columbia University. As a public health professional, she works at the intersection of health, science, and policy. Her research addresses the link between environmental exposures and health effects, especially among vulnerable populations, such as pregnant women and children. She has worked in the private, government, and nonprofit sectors, including management of maternal and child health education and research projects on potential health effects of oil and gas development. Thank you so much, Ms. Webb, for being on the call with us, and I would like to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much for the introduction. It's great to be here with all of you. So we can go ahead and advance to the next slide. I just want to take a moment to recognize the Center for Environmental Health that has helped make all of this work possible. CEH focuses on the protection of families and communities from toxic chemicals, and the development of this work speaks directly to their mission as an organization to be able to provide information and tools to protect communities that are fighting for healthier environments. So you can find more about their work on their website, which is www.ceh.org. Next slide. So this is the outline of what I'm going to be trying to cover today. There's a lot to cover, so I'm going to go through some of these parts rather quickly. I'm going to try to not speak too fast. I will probably go through susceptibility and pathways of exposure fairly quickly because I think most of us are pretty familiar with that. Next slide. So for this study, my colleagues and I took the first comprehensive look at whether there is risk for adverse neurological and neurodevelopmental harm from unconventional oil and natural gas development, which I will here on out refer to as UOG. This also includes hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. And specifically, we focus on five major pollutant categories, which I will get to in a moment. Over the last 10 years, peer-reviewed research findings from academic centers around the world have strongly established the connection between toxicants and neurodevelopmental problems in children and neurodegenerative problems in older adults. So the purpose of our study was to highlight how vulnerable populations, particularly newborns and growing children, may suffer from exposure to UOG-related air and water pollutants. Next slide. So for this review, we focus on the scientific literature relevant to potential neurodevelopmental health effects of UOG emissions on children and newborns. And this required looking at a series of different types of research. So we looked at UOG air and water emissions and concentrations of studies that have been done on that. We also looked at neurological health risks and symptoms from exposure to our pollutant list, and then also long-term health outcomes from early life exposure to UOG-associated pollutants in other contexts as documented in the literature. I just want to note that we did not do a formal quality assessment of the literature, so we did not do a systematic review. Additionally, although we primarily focus on human studies, we also refer to animal studies to be able to understand the biological mechanisms of neurotoxicity. And also just to note that in some cases we did look at adult and occupational studies. We predominantly focused on a peer-reviewed scientific literature, but in a couple cases we did look at reports in gray literature. And our methods are really intended to help identify exposure pathways and mechanisms as well as potential health risks from long-term consequences of air and water pollutants that are associated with UOG. I also want to note that in our paper, we note cases where researchers had found concentrations that exceeded relevant air and water quality standards or guidelines or levels known to be hazardous to human health. You know, for purposes of today, we don't have much time. I'm not going to discuss those studies measuring these chemicals and in what quantities they've been found. If you're interested in looking at that, I urge you to look at the paper for that information. And also, I think most of us are familiar with UOG and fracking, but just I want to mention, so UOG generally refers to oil and natural gas produced from atypical sources. So this includes shale and tight formations. And we focus specifically on research pertaining to onshore oil and gas development from shale and tight formations, oil and gas in particular. Okay, next slide. So let's talk about some of the sources of air and water pollution from UOG. So throughout the UOG's operations life cycle, water pollution is released. So there's wastewater disposal, transport, and during transport before and after hydraulic fracturing, flowback or produced water. So this is the water that travels to the surface following hydraulic fracturing. This can seep into groundwater. And so, for example, arsenic and manganese, which are two of our chemicals of concern that we focus on that have been found near UOG sites, these have been found in flowback or produced water. Next slide. And sources of air pollution. So the UOG operations emit a lot of air pollutants throughout their life cycle. So this includes extraction and processing of natural gas, transportation to compressor stations and pipelines, truck transportation of materials to and from well pads. So, for example, particulate matter, which is another one of our chemicals of concern, this has been found in, we know this is in diesel truck exhaust. Also, the BTEX chemicals are another group of chemicals that we're concerned about and we talk about in our paper. These also can be released from natural gas wells. Next slide. And next slide. So let's talk about the UOG chemicals of concern. So there are many, many chemicals associated with UOG, and so one of the limitations of the study is that we focus on only five particular pollutant categories. Next slide. So at this point, we're on the slide looking at chemicals of concern. So these are the particular pollutant groups that we chose these chemicals because they have been found in significant concentrations in air and water in or near UOG sites. And they also have been commonly repeatedly found in the literature over and over again in epidemiological studies to be associated with adverse neurological and neurodevelopmental health outcomes. So we look at the BTEX chemicals. We focused on PAHs, endocrine disrupting chemicals, heavy metals, and in this case, arsenic and manganese, and also particulate matter. Next slide. And next slide. So now we're going to be looking at windows of vulnerability. So the body undergoes rapid growth and differentiation in the first few years of life. The perinatal period and childhood are accompanied by changes in organ system functioning, metabolic capabilities, physical size, behavior. All these things can dramatically modify the effects of toxicant exposure. Next slide. In utero is a particularly vulnerable time because chemicals can pass through the placenta and blood-brain barrier. Next slide. Also, with infants are also highly susceptible. The mother's chemical burden can be high, and chemicals can pass through breast milk. Next slide. And then, as we know, children are really, really uniquely susceptible for a number of different factors and behaviors. Next slide. And during adolescence and just before is a very vulnerable time. There's actually a lot of self-differentiation going on even during this period that can make us vulnerable. Next slide. So the brain has approximately 86 billion neurons, which are joined together through some 100 trillion connections, which gives rise to a very sophisticated biological machine. So this image right here is by Greg Dunn, who's a neuroscientist and artist, and it's looking at 500,000 cells and the tracks that they form. So it's just 500,000 cells. And you can see that it's color-coded, and you can see what we need to understand about brain function is that the brain could malfunction anywhere along any of these tracks. So it really demonstrates how interconnected the brain is and highlights how small effects in one area could really potentially impact other parts of the brain. Next slide. So brain during, you know, brain development is very, you know, sensitive. During the prenatal period of brain development, there's a lot of, you know, very a remarkable time of transformation, beginning with the formation of neural tube at 2 weeks gestational age, and then ending with at birth with the central nervous system. Within the developing brain, billions of cells must be precisely located, interconnected, and specialized. So to really be able to achieve this, the neurons need to be able to develop and migrate along very precise pathways. So you can see the, you know, how easy it is for something to go wrong. Next slide. The period after birth is also considered a period of enhanced vulnerability, for different reasons, right? So the brain is still remodeling and organizing, and it will continue to do so long into adulthood. So here you can see the little bumps in development when the brain is in a particular critical period for a different function, language, vision, hearing. So the brain is constantly changing and responding to its environment throughout the entire period. And hormones are involved in determining when these windows open and close. Next slide. So here's the endocrine system. So the male and female brains are very different. They're different in a lot of different ways. Largely it's shaped by hormones. The primary endocrine glands are producing and secreting hormones. A lot of what we know about EDCs, for example, we know a lot about estrogen, androgens, and thyroid, but we don't know so much about some of these other hormone functions that are important not only for our physiology as adults, but also during development. But when we're concerned, when we talk about EDCs, EDC activity has been found near UOG sites, we're concerned with because they have been linked with adverse neural and behavioral outcomes. Next slide. This is Philip Grandjean's book, Only One Chance. We talk about his work in our paper. He summarizes a large volume of literature on how exposures to EDCs have been linked to effects in humans. So right here is the list. So we talked to Heather Podesal, who's a colleague of mine, who one of the co-authors in the paper. This is, you know, according to her and other researchers, this is what we are concerned about when we think about neurodevelopment and EDCs. Okay, next slide. So now we're going to talk about neuropsychology and behavior and some of our chemicals of concern and what has come up. So, what has come up in the studies over and over again. So we'll take a moment and talk about self-regulation skills. So self-regulation skills, as we understand, is the child's ability to gain control of bodily functions and manage emotions and maintain focus and attention. So recently, researchers from Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health and the New York State Psychiatric Institute reported that early life exposure in utero to PAH solution may play a role in the cause of many childhood behavior disorders, including ADHD, OCD, Tourette's, and other problems. And in one particular study, they found that children between the ages of 3 and 11 years of age that had been prenatally exposed to PAHs failed to improve their self-regulation skills, while children and mothers that did not appear to have the presence of PAH and DNA adducts displayed increased capacity for self-regulation. We've also seen in other studies with our chemicals of concern this problem with impaired self-regulation. So a birth study in Nepal, for example, looking at arsenic, found a significant inverse association between in utero exposure to arsenic and newborn's self-regulation. We've also seen problems with anxiety and depression and what is called conduct disorder problems, which are antisocial behaviors that some actually see as a precursor to antisocial personality disorder. So we've seen this over and over again. So, for example, with PAHs, we've seen this. There have been, for example, researchers found a dose-response relationship between prenatal PAH exposure, again, which is one of our chemicals of concern, and reductions of white matter in the brain that resulted in high scores for ADHD symptoms and conduct disorder problems. And we've also seen this with heavy metals as well. And then further, I just want to mention also anxiety is another high symptoms of anxiety. So particulate matter exposure has been associated with high symptoms of anxiety. And so one of the mechanisms for that is believed to be that, you know, especially during the prenatal and early period of life, that during brain development, neuroinflammation is linked to anxiety. Next slide. So I'll now talk about neurocognitive effects. So exposure to pollutants, including our pollutants of concern that have been found near ULG sites, it has been linked to neurodevelopmental effects, such as neuronal lesions, which I'll get to. So particulate matter, one of our pollutants of concern, is a series of studies comparing the effects of air pollution in Mexico City with those of similar cities with significantly lower pollution. Researchers have consistently found not only things like neuroinflammation or neuronal damage, but also white matter hyperintensities, which are actually vascular lesions that are regularly found in the elderly, which predicts things like dementia and blood-brain barrier disruption. But it's rare to find these in children. So what's really interesting about these studies that we focused on was that in one study comparing children from Mexico City from children from less polluted areas using MRI imaging, prefrontal white matter hyperintensities were found in 56% of clinically healthy children from Mexico City compared to 7.6% of children that were from the control site. And white matter hyperintensities are linked with problems with memory and executive functions as well as lower IQ. And we've also seen this with PAHs. So PAHs, again, one of our chemicals of concern that have been found near USG sites. High prenatal exposure to PAHs have been reported to be linked to impaired neurodevelopmental health and reductions in pulse scale and verbal IQ scores. We've seen this also with the heavy metals as well. Next slide. So also, neurodevelopmental effects. And I just want to mention there's clearly overlap between these different categories. But with neurodevelopmental effects, we've seen things like neurotube defects. So neurotube defects is including spina bifida, which occurs when the neural tube does not close by the 28th day of gestation. And it can lead to all kinds of problems after. It's been found with a number of our different pollutants of concern. So arsenic has been shown to induce neural tube defects and a number of different animal studies. There was a first study in humans looking at environmental exposure to arsenic and the risk for neural tube defects, and they found that there was an increased risk. Also, benzene, which is one of our chemicals of concern. So in Texas, a state where there's very high ambient benzene levels, mothers living in areas with high benzene levels are reported to more likely have children with spina bifida than women living in areas with lower levels. And then we've also seen it with the PAHs. So with PAHs, one particular study actually found that higher levels of PAHs in the placenta was associated with a 4.5-fold increase in the risk of neural tube defects compared to controls. And then there's other problems like neurological problems, that auditory processing and balance neuromuscular and motor function. And then also things like delayed development of speech. Next slide. I just want to take a moment to mention also, the small for gestational age, reduced birth weight, length, and head circumference. These are all things that have come up also with our chemicals of concern. So, for example, one researcher found that children with high prenatal PAH exposure, they were more likely to be preterm or small for gestational age. And actually, they believe that these adverse effects during fetal development may be caused by PAH's ability to change the endocrine hormone and receptor levels in the brain. And just to note that again, reduction of weight and head circumference has important implications for later on. It's correlated with lower IQ, lower, you know, problems with cognitive function and school performance. Next slide. So, you know, studies have begun to assess a more a direct link between UOG and adverse health outcomes. There have been a number of studies at the time of this review, over 1,000 peer-reviewed articles that are looking at the various health hazards and risks of UOG. But there's definitely a far more substantive body of science than there was even, you know, 5 years ago. But there's still only a limited number of epidemiological studies that are looking at the associations between risk factors such as air and water contamination and health outcomes in human populations living near UOG development. In terms of what we focused on, so published research focusing on the association between UOG and neurodevelopmental and neurological health in humans is limited. There's been a few studies that have, you know, looked at this while looking at a lot of other things. But there's been no actual studies, epidemiological studies focusing exclusively on this topic, which is why we really feel like there needs to be more work in this area. But neurological health problems have been reported by residents living near UOG. Neurological defects have been observed in animals and livestock that are in close proximity to UOG development. Next slide. I just quickly mentioned, so one of the biggest studies, I don't have time to get into all the studies, but one of the studies that came out in 2014, McKenzie and colleagues in Colorado looked at maternal proximity to natural gas wells in rural Colorado and the incidence of birth defects recorded by the state. They found that living within 10 miles of a natural gas well was probably associated with increased risk of neural tube defects. Next slide. You know, essentially, at least five polluting categories are associated with the problems that we talked about today. I won't read through them because we have limited time. But you know, these are the problems that we talked about, and you know, exposure to chemical pollution clearly has the potential to cause neurodevelopmental and neurological health. Next slide. So the key takeaways. The key takeaways are that, you know, there has been and continues to be a dramatic expansion of UOG activity and operations. UOG development results in elevated toxic air and water contamination near human populations. There's a large number of chemicals that have been measured and reported, and there's still actually a large lack of information about what some of these chemicals are. These chemicals have been directly linked with neurological and neurodevelopmental health outcomes in laboratory and epidemiological studies. So although the data is still emerging, it's clear that these have been documented well in other contexts. Next slide. So one of our recommendations that we talked about is the precautionary approach. So to protect the health of children and well-being of families, state and federal agencies and authorities really should be adopting a precautionary approach when establishing rules and standards for UOG development. Also, surface setback limits. So legal setback distances from UOG activity has been a topic that's been a lot of people have been focusing on this lately. And it's intended to protect the health and safety of residents, including infants and children. And usually these setbacks are established as a result of negotiation between residents and policymakers. But even in those places where setbacks have been established, a lot of concerns, there's still a lot of concerns about that these current setbacks are not protective enough. And so we recommend that at a minimum 1 mile setbacks, but really preferably greater. And we just did this based on what we know that has come out. But really, there needs to be more research in this area. And then also, with, you know, there needs to be more robust monitoring protocols and practices. Also, we need to be, you know, looking at the health burden and economic and social effects of this problem. So just for example, ADHD imposes a huge cost to society, something between 36 and 52 billion annually. Is the cost that ADHD poses. EDCs, there's been research done by the European Union on EDC exposure induced neurobehavioral deficits and disorders, and it was estimated that it exceeded 150 billion euros. There hasn't been anything that I know of that has been done in the U.S. That's clearly something that would be interesting to look at here. So clearly there are costs, and these costs get handed over to future generations. So it's a huge burden to society. Next slide. We also need to be improving the specificity of inventories. So we need to being able to more finely pinpoint where these emissions are occurring and the fingerprint of what these emissions are. We clearly need more disclosure and transparency about the chemicals. And then we also need to be investing in sustainable measures for clean energy solutions. This is just a picture just to show quickly, so you can see how quickly we talk about setbacks, how quickly a school is to a well site, or how quickly a home is to a drill rig. Next slide. So research recommendations. So, you know, clearly we need more data. What are people actually being exposed to? What are the blood levels of people living in these areas? So one way to do that is to do biomonitoring. We need more systematic and comprehensive epidemiological studies. We need better population exposure assessment. Next slide. And we also need to be removing the research barriers and improving transparency. That's a huge problem here, where a lot of health professionals want to be able to treat their patients, but without full transparency, it's very difficult for them to do so. And then we also need to be understanding better, you know, like what is happening during these windows of susceptibility, and why are children and infants, and why during in utero are children so uniquely susceptible. More research needs to be done on that as well. Next slide. So in conclusion, there are so many unknowns. The science literature is just beginning to emerge, but there's so much that we already know about long-term health hazards from many of these historical environmental toxins. And it's reasonable to predict based on what we know that there may be health problems and diseases that can result from further environmental insults, such as some UOG-related activity. And with that, I am done. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. What a great presentation. I just want to make a little announcement. We're having some technical difficulties with our website. It seems to be down at the moment, so our chat function is not live right now. So I will open it up to a few questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press *7 to unmute your line. And after you ask your question, if you would please mute your line again to keep the noise, the background noise down, we would sure appreciate it. But I will start off the question. We did have a question posted on the ReadyTalk site. So Reed Detron asks, another pathway of concern is emissions from the use of aromatics, BTEX, in gasoline, typically 20 to 25% per gallon. These are the most likely molecules to produce PAHs and pollution, particularly through long-lasting secondary organic aerosols. Have you evaluated the relative importance of this pathway?
That's a great question. So when we looked at BPX, BPX, we did not, I don't believe we looked at specifically what you're referring to. But we know that these compounds are naturally found in crude oil. They can be found in natural gas and oil operations. They're clearly a problem, and we need to be evaluating this area more carefully.
So, Kim, while we're waiting for some other questions, do you have any questions that you could ask Ellen?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
This is Chris Rezazian from EPA. I'm a mechanical engineer, and I work with the National Environmental Policy Act for tens of thousands of gas wells and oil wells, and we usually try to do a toxics analysis for it. And, you know, to date, the largest setback we've been able to achieve was for the Continental Divide Crestone, or CDC, project in Wyoming for 8,900 wells. And we were able to get a mile setback not from well pads, but from evaporation, compression, and gas plants. And I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that analysis and had the opportunity to look at it. I'm sure as soon as you do, you'll notice the deficiencies as far as what we're inventorying. But I wanted to point that out. Another one that is coming up, we may get a mile and a quarter setback for, but again, probably not from the well pad itself. So if you have any input as to how we could improve inventorying for the pad site and for the fracturing period, we would love to have that information.
Yeah, so I would be happy to share with you. I'm assuming you know some of the studies that have come out on this around setbacks and health concerns. I just want to emphasize that, you know, our results, you know, suggest that the setbacks may not be sufficient to reduce potential threats to human health. Our recommendation, as you said, is, you know, it's just based on what we've understood from reading in the literature, but clearly there needs to be a lot more done here. I would love to take, you know, the opportunity to read more about what your work and, it sounds very important. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would also just point out that those setbacks are based purely on long-term cancer from a limited number of the BTEX components, so it's fairly crude.
Great. Thank you.
This is Carol Kwiatkowski. I just wanted to thank you, Ellen, for a great paper here and for speed presenting. You packed a lot of information into a short time period. We maybe should have had an even longer call for you. But given how many policy recommendations there are, I wonder just from your own gut feeling what you think is the most urgent next step that should be taken. I know that's a tough thing to answer, but I'm just curious from your perspective.
Yeah, no, that's a really important, good question. So I really think that we need to be getting more data. So I know that there are studies that are, you know, currently going on. We really need more data from, you know, people that are residing and working and living near UOG development. Answers like what are people actually exposed to? You know, we know some of the chemicals, but some of them we don't. You know, what are the blood levels of people living, you know, in these areas? So it's absolutely, I think, in the realm of possibility that at current exposure levels, we might expect to see some of these effects. But really, at the very least, we need to be looking for them. We need to be studying them. We need to be looking at it. We also, we really need improved exposure assessment. So, one of the things is, you know, because there's currently a very small number of studies looking at the relationship between the pollution from UOG and undesirable outcomes, there needs to be better population exposure assessment to be able to document these relationships. I think there's a number of different things. I think the good news is that people are paying attention and there's been work clearly being done in this area. We just need to continue going in that direction and I think move swiftly, as quickly as we can.
Well, it looks like we're past the end of our time. Kim, did you have any closing comments?
So, yeah, I just want to thank you so much for presenting and making it through all that. And I encourage people to go read your paper so they can get even more details. And I'd also like to thank everyone for participating on the call and let you know that we will have more calls and webinars in 2018, so please stay tuned. And now back to you, Chris.
Thanks, Kim. I just want to make sure that everyone knows that we will have an MP3 recording of this call available on our website soon, and we encourage you to share it with others. And again, we do apologize for all of the technical difficulties, and our website should be back up live very shortly. We will be hosting more calls in the future, and we'll send out emails to let you know about them. We also have recordings of previous calls on our website, and we would encourage you to listen to the recordings if you were not able to join the calls. Again, I would like to thank Ellen for taking the time to present her research, Kim, our moderator, and thank you to all of the participants for taking the time out of your day to join us. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day.